Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Good, welcome to the DMZ, everyone. And Bill, it was great seeing you recently. We actually got to hang out a little bit, have lunch here in your nation's capital.
It's a very rare foray into Southern DMZ for me,
Yeah.
foreign territory. But we had a lovely chat and lunch with the great Carl Cannon over at Real Clear Politics, who for some reason decides to publish my scribbles a couple times a month, and works across the street from you. So do you guys see each other more often?
Well, I see him more often than when I worked for him. He used to be my editor at Politics Daily, and I never saw him because we all work remote. Rarely saw him, only at parties and stuff, like Christmas parties. So, but now I bump into him occasionally. But not as much as I should. Carl Cannon, great guy, by the way, and everyone should be reading him. And he puts out this great daily newsletter at Real Clear Politics. I would highly recommend signing up for that. Good stuff.
Well, and what he does there, he puts out a summation of what's on the Real Clear Politics site and news and opinion from around the country, but he always adds a historical anecdote every day. There's 5 days he's doing historical anecdotes, and he actually had a 9/11 anecdote today, a story I had not heard before. I guess he was at one of these Christian Science Monitor breakfasts, which so the newsmakers come and have a long conversation and often talking more expansively than they might in a shorter interview. That's a tradition that's been going on for a very long time. And apparently James Carville and Bob Shrum were talking down George Bush's political prospects on the morning of 9/11 at this breakfast, when all of a sudden all the phones light up and they saw that the towers were hit. And as everyone's scrambling to their news decks, Carville says that disregard everything that was said today. Everything's changed. Like immediately, politics is right on his mind.
That tells you all.
So I thought that was interesting anecdote on a otherwise somber day. But there is tons of political activity going on in Washington, and I gotta say, You know, you and I talked last week about that it was not a good idea for conservatives to force another shutdown over the Planned Parenthood issue. But I feel like you and I have a pretty good read on, you know, what the mindset is of the House conservatives. You probably better than me being there, but I feel like I try to be fair and detached when I look at it. I was doubly shocked to see, one, the House conservatives get mad at the House leadership over the Iran deal process, that you're not fighting to stop the Iran deal hard enough when obviously the jig is up, and then to have a renewed conversation about ousting Boehner, as if doing that is going to accomplish anything that conservatives want. I am truly gobsmacked that we're back at the same place before the midterms. You have a good midterm. You know, Gingrich got into trouble after they had a bad midterm. Boehner had a good midterm. He's got a bigger cushion in the House. The polls for the general election are dead heats. They're better. Was in a better position than they thought they were going to be at this time. Why are you causing problems? What is the impetus for this? It's totally befuddling to me.
Well, it seems like my theory is that a segment of conservatives in the House have just decided that they can't really do anything else. You know, they can't. They're kind of impotent to change things. You know, they can't stop Obama's Iran deal, despite having a majority. They can't defund Planned Parenthood, despite having a majority. The one thing they probably can do is claim a scalp, and that would be John Boehner. And in absence of being able to accomplish anything else, maybe they can convince themselves that that solves everything. That the real problem is that Vayner just doesn't fight hard enough, that he acquiesces to the Democrats too much, and that it would be different if they were able to get new leadership, that somehow the leadership has betrayed them or just hasn't pushed hard enough. And that to me is the best theory as to why this focus. I think the Iran stuff is pretty easy. Everybody on the Republican side agrees that the Iran deal was a bad deal. There's really no downside to passing these I don't know what you would call them, provisions through the House that, go on record, condemning the deal, saying we need to see the side deals before it becomes official. I mean, it's not going to work, but I don't see a downside. The defunding Planned Parenthood thing is where the downside is, right? Because there's a chance that could lead to a government shutdown. And so that's where the problem, I think, for John Boehner is there could be a position where he either shuts down the government or is ousted. That's my reading of it, that that's his most dangerous area. But what do you think, Bill?
Well, I'm still confused about the Iran thing, because they had an opportunity at the beginning of the week to, follow the process as it was laid out in the Iran review, Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act. There'd be a resolution of disapproval that would clear the House. It would go to the Senate. And it was kind of dicey whether or not, say, Democrats are going to filibuster it. They had 42 senators saying they would support the deal, but one of them at least was indicating he wasn't going to follow through with the filibuster. Then you only would need one more after that to not filibuster, and then you would at least put it on Obama's desk and make him veto it. So there'd be a certain symbolic victory. That only by Obama's pen,
right,
does this deal survive. And instead of following through on that that strategy, just to backtrack a second, you can say the deal goes through no matter what. But if you're trying to generate political support for the opposite position, and a chance of undoing it later on, the symbolism has some potential. Point. So instead, the House conservatives and Ted Cruz get it in their head that, well, Obama hasn't followed the law because he hasn't given the Congress the full agreement. There's a quote-unquote side deal between Iran and the IAEA that's secret, and until that comes to us, the full parameters of the law have not been fulfilled. And there is language in the law that talks about side agreements and agreements with other parties that you have to give it all over. So, they have a nominal case, but the IAEA has so-called safeguard agreements with 180 countries for all of their work. And in almost all cases, that's kept secret. That's sort of par for the course of how they operate. So in that respect, it's not part of the Iran deal. It is part of the implementation process that it would be presumed would have to go this way. So Obama doesn't have the safeguard agreement in his hands to give. And there'd be no expectation they would ever have that. So you have the House now hung up on this point, and they will likely vote to say this week. You have not given us the full deal. This Corker Cardin process hasn't gone forward, but that provision is not going to clear the Senate, of course.
Yeah.
And I don't see what legal standing you would have when the Congress can't even agree on that point to go to a court and say Obama's not fulfilled his due diligence here. And it's extremely judges are extremely reluctant to get involved in foreign policy disputes between the executive and the legislative.
Yeah.
So now Obama gets to implement the deal without Congress having any opportunity to formally disapprove. So I just don't get why they had to take it to that level on this.
Well, okay, so I think there are three measures, two of which you mentioned. One, of course, is just sort of condemning. So one is sort of a vote just to show that they don't support the deal. The other is condemning the side deals, and the other is a bill banning the administration from lifting sanctions. And I think you're correct that that none of those three things will actually, matter, but they get to go on record as being against this Iran deal, and they get to say they tried every, as Boehner said yesterday, we'll use every tool at our disposal to stop, slow, and delay this agreement. So it just shows that they're trying everything. And I think, though, the interesting thing to me here is that this is really no skin off John Boehner's nose. I mean, it's a fool's errand, probably. It's a moot point, but it's symbolic, and I don't really see a downside to it. But when it comes
Well,
to
the downside would be that it once again makes the Republicans look divided and in disarray, that they can never get on the same page with a basic strategy, and they also can't do any. They can't take any issue, no matter how sensitive. This is foreign policy. It's supposed to be politics stops at the water's edge, all that kind of
yeah.
stuff. That now descends into the most petty, fractious partisan politics. And then it's going to feed right into this whole Planned Parenthood deal, where once again it seems like the House and Senate Republicans can't get on the same page, and they just seem like the same sort of sophomore fractious bunch all over again.
Right, but I think okay, so I think you're right. I mean, marginally, passing these, there may be some downside to like going through this exercise with Iran, but I think the upside of keeping the base happy, showing that you're doing everything you can to try to slow or stop the Iran deal, by far outweighs it. I don't think it really moves the needle that much either way. But the possibility for, defunding Planned Parenthood leading to a government shutdown, to me, is a much more interesting story. And what does Boehner do? If he
And it seems like they now have the votes in the House. The House Freedom Caucus would seemingly have enough people saying on the record, we won't pass any bill to keep the government open that funds Planned Parenthood in any way. We talked about this last week. Boehner is going to have to get Democratic votes if he's going to get a bill through
Right.
now. I suppose he could start with a bill that defunds Planned Parenthood, but once that's a dead letter in the Senate, because that would get filibustered, he's back to having to beg Democrats for
Right.
votes. So it
Yeah.
seems like we're to get to that point pretty
Yeah,
quickly.
they're going to pass a bill, a CR that includes defunding Planned Parenthood. It'll die in the Senate. And then if Boehner tries to pass a clean bill, that's when there could be a problem. You mentioned the Freedom Caucus. These are people like Mark Meadows, who filed a motion to remove Boehner, Jim Jordan, Justin Amash, and Mick Mulvaney, just to name a few. And remember, in January, 25 Republicans voted against Boehner as Speaker. All you need is 30. And this is not a joke. I mean, I think it's certainly possible that Boehner could be ousted.
I mean, that's crazy, right? That's a crazy thing to have
Yeah,
happen in this
I don't
moment.
think it's crazy. I mean, look, if you've got a baseball team or a football team that's perpetually losing and underperforming, sometimes you get rid of that manager or that coach, and it's not always the coach's fault necessarily. Boehner's had a pretty good run or pretty long run at this point. The problem I think for the conservatives is that there's a chance that they end up with worse than what they've got. There's probably the best possible scenario would be Jeb Hensarling or Tom Price, somebody out of the Republican Study Committee school of thought, who's pretty conservative, but also respected, and also respected to become speaker. Second best scenario would be they cut a deal With McCarthy, who's the majority leader now, where the conservatives would elevate McCarthy to the speaker, and they'd bring in a hardcore conservative as the majority leader.
But McCarthy's considered an establishment type, a Boehner type. Yeah. He's not considered a Tea Party guy.
That's why this would be like a coalition deal. You only do that. But see, then McCarthy becomes a puppet, and then his time is limited, right? Like, once you get a hardcore conservative as majority leader and McCarthy as speaker, how long before they turn on McCarthy and he's gone? So those are the best case scenarios. There are other scenarios where Boehner survives by forming an alliance with Democrats to support him, and then he's sort of liberated from having to please the Republican caucus and certainly the Freedom caucus. And then there's another scenario where Democrats elect a very moderate Republican speaker. And so you actually get a more moderate speaker than John Boehner. So it's not a guarantee that this, even if the coup succeeds, that it will, you know, you might end up with, I mean, this happens in real coups, right? Where meet the new boss, same as the old boss kind of.
I mean, you said earlier that the impetus of this is a sense that the coach keeps losing, and so you have to replace the coach. And I feel like this also applies to what's going on in the Republican primary. I mean, the Republican base seems to have a very warped sense of what constitutes winning and losing. And, you know, so even though Republicans won the midterms, even though they can't, Obama can't implement the vast majority of the things that he would like to do. Yes, he just because he wins on some things that are very much within his purview, like foreign policy, that means you're getting shut out as opposed to maybe losing by a run in the middle of the game.
Yeah, it's perception, but I mean, I guess two things. Like, number one would be like if a tree falls in the woods and no one hears it, did it? Like, you know, you don't hear the stories about the things that Obama wants to do but decides he can't do, or the things that Republicans bottle up in committee. I mean, those, what you hear about are the executive orders, the Iran deal, you know, the fact that we're still funding Planned Parenthood, whatever. I mean, so that's part of it. The other thing, I will say, though, I think that there is a symbolic benefit to shaking up leadership potentially. I don't think that that's the answer, or that this is like a panacea. I think it's sort of naive to think that. But I also think that, you know, sometimes shaking things up, you know, what can you do? I mean, you got to change, you know, is it a coincidence that the Denver Broncos didn't start winning Super Bowls until they changed their uniforms? I don't know. Seems to be held true, though.
But how many? Well, let's keep this on sports. How many managerial shakeups actually lead to the team performing better? I mean, or how many times is just sacking the manager is treating that guy like a scapegoat when your team is actually not that good? Or in this case, you know, you're up against a president who was duly elected and has certain executive branch powers, and therefore he's going to get to do certain things. And changing your speaker just doesn't affect that.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. And I should throw in the Patriots, too, right? They didn't start winning Super Bowls till they got those new uniforms. Look, I would argue, Bill...
Well, that's what we're arguing for, rampant cheating, that the Republicans should know how to cheat better, then they might win more stuff.
Well, Bill Belichick would be an example of someone who comes in and turns around an organization. So it happens, but it doesn't always work.
But it's a matter of what is the fundamental problem. I mean, the fundamental problem that House Republicans have right now is the constitutional system of checks and balances, not Boehner's strategic decision-making. They can't get around the fact that there are 40-plus Senate Democrats and a Democratic president. Those are the obstacles. Boehner's not the obstacle.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think that, you know, Obama he passed Obamacare during a brief time when Democrats controlled three branches of government, you know, or three. They controlled both houses of Congress and the presidency. And that's a rare thing. And then they still needed to use reconciliation and trickery and all sorts of other stuff to actually get it done. And but here's the thing that Republicans tell me, and I interviewed John Hawkins from Right Wing News on my podcast recently, and he said, you know, let's give Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid some credit here. Sorry, Bill, my computer froze up there for a second. Hopefully, doesn't mess things up too bad. I'll just keep rolling. He gave so John Hawkins says, you know, okay, granted, you know, Democrats had the presidency, they had the Senate, they had the House. But Harry Reid and Nancy Pelosi were willing to put their majorities on the line in order to push through an agenda, right? So just getting elected, just winning midterms doesn't constitute a win. You know, changing policy constitutes a win. And Pelosi and Reid were willing to jeopardize or sacrifice their majorities in order to actually change America and pass policies. And then the question is, would Republicans do the same thing? And Hawkins concludes that no, that even assuming Republicans had this sort of supermajority and they could get anything done, they wouldn't have the stomach to push through a conservative agenda that would be like as radical as Obamacare. And you know what? I think Hawkins might actually be right about that, for what it's worth.
Well, I think there's, I mean, that's an important issue. I mean, here's where the leadership does matter. You know, how do Republicans use the congressional majority they have right now, even though they don't have the White House? And they have chosen not to spend the last 8, 9 months passing legislative items that highlight what their preferred agenda is. You know, they didn't say, well, here's what we would do on health care, and here's what we would do on immigration, here's what we would do on tax reform. They haven't been able to do that. Now, I personally would not pin that on leadership. They're not doing it because their caucuses are not unified on those subjects. So they can't put those bills on the floor and have them actually clear the Congress very easily, because they would be stuck in these same kind of interesting battles that they're into anyway. And so I would say that blame largely falls on the Tea Party side of things, because their obsession is not making the leadership pass policy agenda items. Their obsession is, how can we be a bigger wrench in Obama's works? So the whole focus is not on showing off what the conservative agenda is right
All
now.
right, well, that's a fair point. But so, like, let's say that I think we probably agree that, like, John Boehner isn't the problem. But maybe they need to learn that. And maybe getting rid of Boehner is the best way to learn that he wasn't the problem. And what does it matter? He's probably going to retire sooner rather than later anyway. The only, like, even if we'll concede he's not the problem, I think we'd probably concede he's also not like the master of the house. I mean, he's not like an indispensable leader or member.
He
What
got fast track
other
passed.
than the fact that you may like him, not you, but other than the fact that, like, we may like him personally, we may think that he's fine, like, what's the benefit of keeping him? You know, like, in other words, there may not be a huge benefit. There may not be a huge benefit to getting rid of him, except that we might learn the lesson that it wasn't him. It's us, not him. But what's the downside to getting rid of Boehner? Especially if you could get, you know, cut a deal and get a conservative either in as speaker or majority leader.
I mean, I have said for a while that I think there is a huge, you know, anchor around the Republican Party because they don't seem like they are really ready to govern in a serious, responsible way. And I had predicted, you know, before the midterms, that it would be good for Democrats if they did lose, because Republicans would then prove that they're not ready for prime time and can't govern in a responsible, serious way. So once you start playing, leadership coup, that does not give a feeling to the public that this is a party that has its act together. I mean, this is not the quite the same. It's not quite analogous, but in Australia, the Labor Party, at least that's a parliamentary system of government. So the party in the parliament, can rotate their leadership if they so choose, without going to a presidential election. And they had this back and forth between their leadership. It was Kevin Rudd, and then it was I forget the woman's name who took over, and then it was Kevin Rudd again. And that back and forth did not give a good feeling to the Australian public, and that whole party got ousted in the subsequent election. So it's not as dire to swap out the speaker, because that speaker's not the presidential candidate. But I do think it gives that same feeling of instability that doesn't make people think this party is prepared to actually control all branches of the government.
Well, I don't think it matters that much. I think that what Donald Trump is doing to the brand is much more damaging. As long as there's not a shutdown, I don't think that the public cares that much about, if Republicans pass show votes or if they change the speaker. I don't think, that it's the brand is going to be tarnished, or it's going to look like they're in disarray, or that they're not that competent. I think it's much more important what happens with Trump and Cruz and Carson and Jeb and all that. And then if you get a Republican president in, that's sort of where the action is. So I don't think it matters that much, but I do think that Boehner could seriously be in jeopardy based on all the things that we've described here. But again, let me say
Well,
that
let's
I think that the one thing that maybe the fever only breaks if you give them a scalp and they see that if Hinterling or somebody becomes speaker, he's not going to be able to wave a magic wand. And maybe that's what it's going to take for people to realize that, like, oh, we can't just make things happen by, like, what is it, the Green Hornet? If you just try
Green
Green
Lantern.
Lantern, I'm sorry. Got my superheroes confused. The Green Lantern, if you just try hard enough, you can make it. If you just fight hard enough, you can make things. You can change the laws of physics, and you can. What is the line from My Cousin Vinny? Were they magic grits? So we shall. I'm not predicting that Boehner's going down, but I am saying, from what I can tell, this is the most serious. He's faced many, challenges and coup attempts, but I think this is getting more serious.
Well, let's shift gears to the Democratic side. Last night we had Joe Biden giving a very emotional interview on the new Late Show with Stephen Colbert, where Colbert is actively almost begging Biden to run for president, and the crowd chanting, "Joe, Joe, Joe," and people interpreting Biden's comments totally different ways, that he's indicating that he's not ready to run, or that he's clearly inching towards having a run. And then you have a CNN poll come out this morning where Hillary's at 37, Bernie Sanders is at 27, and Biden's at 20. And Hillary had dropped 10 points, and Biden had gone up 6, and Sanders was roughly where he was before. You could argue that there's a bit of a Biden boomlet going on. You'd argue that that's because he's not running, and the day he does run, that's his best day, and it would all collapse after that. And I strongly get the sense that Republicans want him to run because it puts the Democratic Party in greater disarray than if he didn't. But can you put that aside, Matt, and say, okay, I really see a logical case for Biden to run? Or do you say, look, there's just no way that he could actually get the nomination? It would just tarnish his legacy. It would divide the party, and then, his last note would be a point of division, not a point of unity. Do you have an objective take of where you think Biden should go from here?
Yes, I do. But first, let me plug something. I interviewed Joe Trippi on my podcast yesterday, And citing that poll where Biden was just at 12% in Iowa, Quinnipiac poll, Trippi poo-pooed the notion that Biden, he said that it would be a very disappointing result if Biden were to win. He said that Biden earned the right to run if he wants to, but aside from, unless Barack Obama wraps his arm around Biden, he doesn't see how, you know, if the public, that 12% in the poll there, if the public is clamoring for somebody other than Hillary, Trippi tells me it doesn't look like it's Joe. Check out that podcast. You can get it on iTunes. Just search for Matt Lewis and the News and listen to that. Bill, I disagree, though. I think that there is an argument for Joe doing this. And I think that argument is a couple things. One, you know, losing his son, you know, there is a courage born of desperation and of despair. And the worst thing that could happen to you has probably just happened to Joe. That, in a way, can be liberating. It can give you why not take this chance? It puts things in perspective. It makes your legacy and all that stuff seem trivial in comparison. So I think that the death of Beau Biden, we've seen leaks from somewhere to Maureen Dowd and others that Beau wanted Joe to do this. I think that makes me lean toward thinking that he might get in. The other thing too is if Hillary does collapse, if people go looking for an alternative, you sort of need to be in the race. There are filing deadlines, unless maybe it goes to a convention or something. But I think generally speaking, if Joe were to get in and sort of run a campaign that is respectful of Hillary, certainly that sort of bides its time, no pun intended, with the Biden name there, he could be the guy that people turn to if she implodes, and that's not beyond the realm of possibility. So I'm leaning toward, you know, I'm 60-40 that Joe gets in, that Joe does run for president, and I think he has a chance I'm not, again, not predicting that this would happen either, but I don't think it's absurd that he could, you know, sitting vice president, two-term vice president. The last thing I'll say, Bill, is this is a guy who clearly wants to be president. James Carville says that running for president's like having sex. Nobody wants to do it just once. Biden did it, ran in 1988. He ran 20 years later in 2008. Clearly a guy who wants to be president, who has the fire in the belly, or has had it in the past, certainly for decades. So I don't know. I put all those things together, and I think Joe runs.
Yeah, I don't understand that Carville line. Running for president sounds horrible. Running for president does not sound
to you and
enjoyable
me.
Like sex.
Well, you and me are normal, but these are political animals with a ravenous political libido. That's why they run. That's why they're different than you and me. And that's why Joe probably gets in.
Well, I'm not going to be a mind reader. I mean, he may well get in because he, like, if he wants it, he wants it. And
the heart wants what the heart
wants. You can't
get
it if you, right. But I think logically, it doesn't make sense because, I mean, it obviously would make the primary very divisive. And look, divisive primaries happen. And, you know, 2008 was very divisive. It all worked out okay in the end. I mean, I think the Democratic Party would survive a divisive primary, but Biden's role in that would, I think, more likely besmirch his legacy than enhance it. He would immediately be accused of being the personification of a glass ceiling on Hillary. I mean, in the case of Obama versus Clinton, some people threw that argument around at the time, but one, it's hard to put that argument around against someone who would be the first African-American president, so there's another ceiling there that he was breaking. But more fundamentally, he had a substantive reason to oppose Hillary at the time. I mean, the Iraq vote was a huge flashpoint in the race, and he was making a case that he had a different set of values and political philosophy that was more reflective of the Democratic Party and superior for a president. Biden doesn't have that vis-a-vis Hillary. They're not from different spectrums of party thinking. They're both mainstream establishment Democrats. So it's more obvious that for him to run is strictly out of personal desire. It's totally ego. That I think I'm better at this than she is, and that's that. It's not because I have a different policy platform that she does that I think is better for the country. So I think the glass ceiling argument hits harder on him, and therefore, instead of being the end of his political career being the most influential and consequential vice president in history, it's a guy who couldn't let it go and went out on a sour note. Whereas if he decided on October 1 to endorse Hillary after all this drama, to come out on the other end and say, you know what, she's really the best. I worked with her. She's going to do a fantastic job. She's earned it. She believes in X, Y, and Z, and I do too. Well, let's all get behind her. He would be heralded in the Democratic Party as a unifying figure. Whatever the Clintons want, whatever he wants from the Clintons, they would give it to him. They would be deeply indebted if you want a role in the administration or whatever, what have you. And so if you want to be Secretary of State or something else, you would get that. If he didn't want to do that, he could open up a Biden center and be like a Jimmy Carter and do almost whatever he wanted on the issues that he wanted to pursue. He'd still be in the game in some way if he chose. Yeah. But he would just be universally loved, and it would not become a bitter polarizing figure, which he would inevitably be if he got into the primary.
Yes, I think you're right. I mean, I think that we've both presented cogent arguments, right? So if we could potentially be advising Biden and two advisors who are presenting equally true but contrasting possible visions, I really then think it comes down to how much of a risk taker he is, and is it, if he is focused on sort of playing it safe and preserving his legacy, then I think he clearly should do what you were suggesting. If he's more ambitious and aggressive and that political libido is still going, people who like, we'll go back to the sort of sexual romantic metaphor, right? People don't always act rationally when it comes to affairs of the heart. They don't play it safe. They take some chances sometimes. And that's the question. Is Biden sort of thinking safe, rational, legacy, long-term comfort, or is he thinking brass ring, go for the, which one of those, and clearly Biden has the, I know there's the affable Uncle Joe guy, but there's also the guy who did a pretty good job of debating Paul Ryan in that vice presidential debate, and there's the guy who ran for president a couple times, two or three times, so over the course of decades. So which of those, angel or devil on his shoulders does he listen to,
Well, we obviously can't, if there's one ahead we cannot get into, it is Joe Biden.
Yeah.
But before we close it out, we weren't planning to talk about the Republican side of the race because I don't know if that much has changed since last week. But I just want to take your temperature. I mean, it seems like it's now a Trump Carson race in a lot of polls. Do you have any sense that maybe are we near the end of Trump? Is the bubble about to burst? Is the next debate gonna do him in?
You're not gonna get me.
Or
to,
is he just a?
I can't. The court, political commentary is just, littered with the corpses of people who've counted Donald Trump out. I'm lucky after the McCain POW gaffe, I said that it was, I at least couched it by saying that it's the beginning of the end. Well, it turns out it was just the end of the beginning. So, I mean, So look, he's going after Mexicans, he's going after POWs, he's going after women, he's going after Carly Fiorina's looks. He said that Ben Carson wasn't a very, you know, that great of a doctor.
He's an okay doctor. Didn't say it was bad.
I okay. Don't know what he can do or say. And the other thing, the amazing thing is that his favorables, which I've never seen this happen ever, are going up. This, you know, that he's been able to reverse the unfavorable number. So it's I can't guess what's going to happen with Trump. I'm
going to flat out tell you what's going to happen
okay.
with Trump.
All right.
He's going to go down, and at the point where the numbers start to go down, I mean the Trump is a classic stock bubble. You know, it's all hot air. There's nothing underlying it, and so at the point where the numbers start to trend lower, where does the bravado go? Every answer he gives to anything is, look at my polls, look at my ratings. So once that's not there anymore, it's just going to go, just collapse, and it's going to be pathetic. So I'm going to lay it right out there. There is no way. The rules of political gravity have not been eliminated. You cannot say this many incredibly stupid and obnoxious offensive
things. How do you know the rules haven't changed? Every once in a while, we go through times where the world changes, and you and I are blessed and cursed by virtue of having followed politics for a long time, and we are basing our predictions and commentary off of history to a certain degree. What's happened in the past, assuming that what's happened in the past will be a predictor of the future. But sometimes everything changes. And what if the world has gone mad and it's Kanye, Oprah, and Donald Trump that get elected president from here on out?
Well, you know, life is not Idiocracy.
It may be.
It's just not rational. No, look, there are plenty of people on the left who think so little of your party that believe, well, Trump is just an authentic reflection of the conservative base, and that's why he can do this in perpetuity. And I submit to you that your party is not that bad, that there is a sense of, let's at least vote for someone who has a plausible chance of winning the White House. And yes, I know there's some general election trial that you can point to where Trump is ahead by a little bit, but it's freaking September, people.
Well, Dave Weigel, it's a year away. I will say Dave Weigel at the Washington Post, I don't know if I agree or not, but he had an interesting observation about a week ago where he said that the fact that Hillary is doing so poorly and she looks vulnerable is actually helping Trump, because Republicans, conservatives, feel like they don't have to play it so safe, right? So if they thought that Hillary was this behemoth that they were going to have a really hard time beating, maybe they would have to play it a little safer. But because Hillary looks so weak and so vulnerable, they can go big, and they can go with the person they really want, who's really inspiring them. They don't have to settle for a politician. They can go for Trump or Carson or Carly. I don't know if that's true or not, but it's an interesting theory.
Well, we're in a summer where Hillary's basically taking it in the teeth almost every day in the summer. It's sort of analogous to where John McCain was in 2007, where John Kerry was in the summer of 2003. All that negative drip, drip, drip is on that person. And other folks who are far less plausible are getting a relative free ride in the media. There is going to be a day where somebody takes the wood to Donald Trump. It's only begun a little bit. You know, Jeb's had a couple of ads. Jindal gave a speech yesterday. There are so many of attack lines that have yet
nobody
to be
can
used
do it
on Trump.
It can't be done in a speech. It can't be done rhetorically, because Bobby Jindal just doesn't look. He's not the guy to do it. You can't get into. The wrestle with the pig sort of line, right? I mean, the pig enjoys it, and you just get muddy. But I think ads are, you know, the whole. Remember the when Mitt Romney came to town, ads that Newt Gingrich's super PAC ran against Romney. We haven't seen money spent taking down Trump, and if there was a super PAC, who did a really good job. I'm sure Trump's got a heart. I mean, we could probably write the ad now. I mean, Trump's got there's a lot of oppo out there on Trump. He's got a lot of problems, but if somebody were to put the money behind it and do a really compelling ad that was brutal and really put the money behind it, then we would see, can that drive up his, can that drive down his favorables, and can you muddy him up so bad? But no one's done that yet, so effectively.
Well, and that's true about Trump. That's true about Carson. That's true about Sanders, and that's true about Biden. None of these people have gone through the grinder yet because it is the fall of 2015.
And I think,
It's months away from
you make a good
Iowa.
point. I think Biden's really susceptible to it. As long as he's a candidate in the abstract, he seems very likable compared to Hillary. But you start getting into his voting record and things he said in the past, and you could probably drive up his unfavorables pretty fast if you
I
start
mean,
spending money.
BuzzFeed just ran a piece about how Biden was cheerleading the Patriot
There you
Act.
go.
And Politico ran a piece about how Biden was the singular white liberal to stop the desegregation busing movement in the 70s. It's also, I mean, and Biden, we all know, but there's plenty of gas. He did not run well in 2008. Sanders has plenty of issue positions that aren't would not sell well in a general election that have not, and there's a piece in Politico today about how Hillary doesn't want to confront Sanders on that because she needs his voters in the general. She doesn't want to be a divisive figure right now. But that stuff's going to have to come out in some way if he's getting close to the nomination. He's going to have to answer those questions. How can you be for single-payer health care, for example? That kind of stuff. So we're not seeing a true. None of the candidates are being put on the same chopping block
Right, but
right now and being tested in the same
I would
way.
also argue that paid ads probably matter less than ever, and that Trump's earned media matters a lot, and he may be Teflon. We don't know if things are going to stick to him. Look, I also say this: another interesting thing happening on the Republican side right now is how Scott Walker's collapsed in Iowa, according to recent polling. I think he went from first place to 10th place in a couple months. So that's interesting. He turned me off. I had hoped that he could straddle the establishment and the conservative lanes, and he turned me off by very transparently going all in to sort of out populist everybody and to try to win Iowa. But I'm surprised that he turned everybody else off too. It wasn't just me. That is
Well, he didn't
surprising.
get better. He started off weak, making odd comments about ISIS and
Not ready for prime time.
flip-flopping immigration. He's not even running prime time. And look, but you could say this not as dramatically, but Rubio has not taken off.
No, but I think Rubio's playing a different game. I think Rubio's is playing a much smarter game. He's not trying to win every news cycle. I think they're basically playing their own game. They're showing up.
Well, I mean, Rubio's better positioned to be VP
Yeah.
than Walker is right now. He hasn't had as many, foot and mouth
Yeah.
problems.
Although I think there's a chance either of those guys come back again, even Walker. I think Walker could, he could get a second look and maybe be more prepared when that happens.
I expect more rounds of 15 minutes for people, but I'm still Team Jeb. My whole plan was to see all these guys get their 15 minutes, and Jeb would be the last one left standing because he's got the most money,
Look,
and I still see us on that track.
if it's Hillary versus Jeb, this dynastic thing, man, I mean, bring on the third party then, right? I mean, seriously.
Be ready for it. Don't say I didn't warn you.
I'm gonna say we should get a bet because I'm gonna bet that it's not Hillary versus Jeb.
I'll humiliate myself and take that bet again.
All right, so it could be any combination. It could be Hillary versus somebody else, or it could be Jeb versus.
Well, I'm already on record. I'm already on record saying it's Hillary
All
versus
right.
Jeb, so I might as well go all
All
in.
right, I'm gonna say it's not.
All right.
So I don't know. We'll figure out stakes later. after I. After
I probably should get some odds on that though. I'm picking two nominees here. You know, you could have any one of like 250 permutations and still win.
I know, so. But I still think. I mean, I mean, I think you're going with the betting markets though. I mean, you're going with the people who would be clear. I think that I saw yesterday on Morning Joe that that the betting markets say Jeb. Despite what the polls say, so.
Right.
Anyway, let me ask you this question, Bill. When you look under the screen that you're looking at, what there's a time. Yeah. I'm at 48 minutes. Where are you?
I'm at 49:15.
Okay. So something happened. There was a little. At some point, there was a glitch as we recorded this. So, so good luck. You know, suits. Suits at Blogging Heads TV. I messed something up somehow. Hopefully most of this is salvaged. So, all right. So go pre-order Too Dumb to Fail, please. Check out my forthcoming book. And also, check out that podcast I did with Joe Trippi. You can get that on iTunes. We talked about Joe Biden and other stuff. Just look for Matt Lewis and the News and Bill. Oh, yeah. Also, follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show. Bill, share. What do you want to plug?
I got nothing to plug.
Yeah, nothing.
Just buy all Matt's things.
You know, they're great Christmas gifts. You could order a few copies of the books. You could, you know, I will not complain. All right. Always good talking to you, Bill. Share.
You too, sir. Take
care. All right. See you all next week.